AK-47s. It occurred to the sergeant that Sammy was unschooled in the art of ambush. The idea was to let the lead vehicle pass and suck in the whole column, then open fire. The unarmored flatbed trucks in the middle, loaded with cooks and clerks and other volunteers, would have made fat, vulnerable targets. By opening up on the lead vehicles, it gave the convoy a chance to back out before things got worse. Strucker shouted for his driver to throw the Humvee in reverse. Those following would just have to figure it out. They slammed into the front of the Humvee behind them, and then that driver threw his vehicle in reverse and backed into the first truck. Eventually, they all got the message. "You need to find a different route," he told his eyes in the sky. "Go back where you came from and turn right instead of left. You can get there that way." Strucker got the whole column back up to the gate, and this time turned right. Looming ahead was a roadblock, a big one. While a lot of the people shooting at them were clearly amateurs, it was obvious there were some experienced military minds among them. This roadblock was nothing spontaneous. They had anticipated the routes a convoy might take from the ranger base and had thrown up barriers of dirt, junk, furniture, vehicle hulks, chunks of concrete, wire, and whatever else was at hand. There were tires burning on it that threw churning clouds into the darkening sky. Strucker could taste the sting of the burning rubber. The convoy knew Super 6-4 was down less than a mile away, directly ahead. Durant would say later that he heard the sound of a 50 cal, which almost certainly was from Strucker's Humvee. The pilot believed deliverance was at hand, but the convoy could advance no closer. Beyond the roadblock, between where they sat and Durant's crippled Blackhawk, was a concrete wall surrounding the sprawling ghetto of huts and walking paths. Strucker knew his Humvees could roll over the roadblock, but there was no way the trucks behind him would make it. And even if they did, there wasn't going to be any way through the concrete wall. "See where those tires are burning? That's where the crash is. Go in 100 meters past it." "You'll have to find us another route," Strucker responded. "There ain't another route." "Well, you need to find one. Figure out a way to get there." "The only other route is to go all the way around the city and come in through the backside." "Fine, we'll take it." Strucker knew every minute mattered. Durant and his crew wouldn't last long. It seemed like it took forever for the 5 tons to turn around on the narrow street. The trucks weren't delicate about it. They rammed into walls and ground gears. As the trucks fought their way around, most of the men moved out into the street to defend the convoy. On one knee in the dirt, Sergeant Cash took a whack on his chest that almost knocked him over. It felt like someone had punched him up near the shoulder. He ran his hand inside his shirt, looking for blood. There was none. The bullet had skimmed off the front of his chest plate, tearing the straps of his load-bearing harness so that it was now hanging by threads. Squeglia saw a round clip off the side view mirror of the truck on the driver's side and reached his M16 across the chest of the driver to return fire. Sizemore unloaded on everything he saw, venting his pent-up rage. Anderson kept his head down, looking for specific targets. He shot a few times, but didn't think he'd hit anyone. When they all got pointed at last in the right direction, the convoy sped out along a road that skirted the city to the southwest, driving through an occasional hail of AK-47 fire. From the peak of one rise, they could see Durant's crash site. It was down in a little valley, but there seemed no easy way to get there. Chapter 8 Up in their Black Hawk, Gofina and Yacon could see both convoys in trouble. Lieutenant Colonel McKnight's battered main convoy was steering back toward the K-4 circle, away from both crash sites, and the emergency convoy of cooks and volunteers wasn't getting close. They again asked to insert their Delta snipers. They were down to just 2 now. Sergeant Brad Hollings had manned one of Super 6-2's miniguns after one of the crew chiefs was injured. They would need him there. Captain Yacon turned around in his seat to discuss the situation with the two Delta operators. "Things are getting bad now, guys," Yacon told them, shouting over the chopper's engines and the sound of the guns. "The second convoy is taking intensive fire, and it doesn't sound like it's going to make it to the crash site. Mike and I have ID'd a field about 25 to 50 yards away from where they went down. There are lots of shacks and shanties in between. Once you get there, you could either hunker down and wait for the vehicles, or try to get the wounded to an open area where we could come back in and get you." Shugart and Gordon both indicated they were ready to go down. Up in the command bird, Harrell pondered the request. It was terribly risky, maybe even hopeless. But one or two properly armed, well-trained soldiers could hold off an undisciplined mob indefinitely. Shugart and Gordon were experts at killing and staying alive. They were serious career soldiers, trained to get hard, ugly things done. They saw opportunity where others could see only danger. Like the other operators, they prided themselves on staying cool and effective even in extreme danger. They lived and trained endlessly for moments like this. If there was a chance to succeed, these two believed they would. In the C-2 bird, seated side by side, Harrell and Matthews weighed the decision. Their entire air rescue team was on the ground already at the first crash site. The ground convoy wasn't going to get to Durant and his crew fast enough, but dropping in Shugart and Gordon would most likely be sending them to their deaths. Matthews turned down the volume on their radios momentarily. "Look, they're your guys," he said to Harrell. "They're the only two guys we've got left. What do you want to do?" "What are our choices?" Harrell asked. "We can put them in, or not put them in. Nobody else is going to get to that crash site that I can see." "Put them in," said Harrell. So long as there was even a tiny chance, they felt obliged to give it to the downed crew. When Gofina's crew chief, Master Sergeant Mason Hall, passed word to the men that it was time to jump, Gordon grinned and gave an excited thumbs up. There was a small opening behind one of the huts. It was bordered by a fence and covered by some debris, but it might do. Gofina made a low pass at it, flaring up near the ground to blow over the fence and scatter the debris. He couldn't get rid of enough of it to land, so he held a hover at about 5 feet as Shugart and Gordon jumped. Shugart got tangled momentarily on the safety line connecting him to the chopper and had to be cut free. Gordon took a spill as he ran for cover. Shugart stood motioning with his hands, indicating confusion. They'd gotten disoriented jumping down and were crouched in a defensive posture in the open, trying to get their bearings. Gofina dropped the chopper back down low, leaned out his door, and pointed the way. One of his crew chiefs flung a smoke grenade in the direction of the crash. The operators both turned thumbs up and began moving that way. Chapter 9. More than a mile to the northeast, back at Chalk 2's original blocking position by the target building, the war had slowed down for Sergeant Ed Urick. After stumbling into the small Somali schoolhouse and coaxing the teacher and children to the floor, Urick had been left in charge of the remnants of his chalk when Lieutenant DiTomaso and 8 other Rangers had sprinted down to help out at the first crash site. Urick had seen the ground convoy drive off. As the fighting shifted to the Black Hawk crash site 3 blocks east, things grew so quiet on Urick's corner, he got spooked. With the lieutenant and his radio man gone, he had no contact with the command radio net. He was worried the whole force had forgotten them. He used his personal radio to call DiTomaso. "What's up, Lieutenant?"
"You need to find your way to me."
"Roger, sir. Where are you?"
"Take that big alley 3 blocks east, then turn left. Go about 200 meters. You can't miss us."
"Roger." It was, and it wasn't, good news. It felt like they'd finally gotten this small corner of Mogadishu tamed. They'd grown familiar with angles of fire and potential danger spots, and had found what seemed to be adequate cover.
The kids in the little tin schoolhouse had been quiet as mice. Yurik had been keeping an eye out for them. Out in this very dangerous city, with bullets and RPGs flying, he was loath to give up what seemed to have become a safe and quiet corner. They could hear heavy shooting over by the crash site, and once they were up and moving down the road, they'd have no cover. Di Tommaso and the first men down the road had at least had the element of surprise. Yurik's would be the second team to pass through the same gauntlet. He had no doubt Sammy would be waiting. "Come on, guys, we gotta go," he reluctantly informed the men. They began moving east down the alley. They walked fast, weapons aimed and ready, in single file, spread out down the south side of the alley. They stayed a few steps off the stone walls on that side of the street. The natural inclination was to get as close to the wall as possible. The wall suggested at least a margin of safety. But Sergeant Paul Howe, one of the D-boys, had advised them against it. "Bullets follow walls," he'd explained. "The enemy can concentrate fire down an alleyway, and the walls on either side will act as funnels. Some rounds would actually ride the walls for hundreds of feet. Standing tight against a wall was actually more dangerous than being in the middle of the street. At the intersections, they would stop and cover each other. Yurik ran, while his men laid suppressive fire north and south. Then he covered for the next man, and so on. They leapfrogged across. It didn't take long for the shooting gallery to open. Sammies would pop up in windows or doorways or around corners and spray bursts of automatic fire. Most were clearly amateurs. The kick of the weapon and their own desire to stay behind cover meant they were unlikely to hit anyone. Yurik figured these were guys just trying not to lose face with their group. They would let a burst fly with their head turned away and eyes closed, fling the weapon, and run. Yurik didn't even bother returning fire for some of these. But some of the men who popped up in windows were different. They didn't shoot instantly. They took aim. They meant business. He figured these were ID's militia guys. There was usually one militia guy for every four or five who shot at them. Yurik and his men invariably shot first. During the long, boring weeks before this mission, they had trained almost daily. Captain Steele had insisted on it. They had unlimited ammo to work with, and out in the desert they had set up a variety of shooting ranges, including this very drill. In practice, targets would pop out unexpectedly. They had different shapes and colors. The rules were, shoot if you see the blue triangle, but hold your fire if it's a green square. Yurik felt the benefit of all that practice. He and his men engaged in a running series of gunfights. He shot one man in a doorway just 10 feet away. The man stepped out and took aim, a bushy-haired, dusty man with baggy brown pants and a lightweight blue cotton shirt with an AK. He didn't shoot instantly, and that's what killed him. Yurik's eyes met his for a split second as he pulled the trigger. The Somali just fell forward out into the alley without getting off a shot. He was the second man Yurik had ever shot. Specialist Lance Twombly blasted at one man with his saw, shooting the big gun from his hip. The Sammy had stepped out from a corner with an AK and started shooting. Both he and the ranger blasted away at each other, not more than 15 yards apart. Twombly saw his rounds. There must have been 40 of them, chipping the walls and spitting up dirt all around his target, and he never hit the man. Nor did the Somali hit Twombly. The Sammy ran off. Twombly just kept on moving, cursing himself for being such a bad shot. Yurik could not believe it when they made it the entire 3 blocks without any of his men being hit. But there was no respite. At the intersection of the main road, he looked downhill and saw Waddell against the wall on his side of the street. Across the street at the opposite corner, behind a big tree and car, were Nelson and Sergeant Alan Barton, who'd roped in from the CSAR bird.
Twombly moved down that side of the street and crossed the road to add his saw to Nelson's M60. There were two dead Somalis stretched out on the ground by the car. Across the street from them, diagonally from Waddell, was a little green Volkswagen. Di Tommaso and some men from the CSAR bird were crouched there. Yorick ran across the road to the car to link up with Di Tommaso. He passed the alley and saw the downed helicopter to his right. Just as he arrived, the Volkswagen began rocking from the impact of heavy rounds. Thunk, 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 thunk. Whatever this weapon was, its bullets were poking right through the car. Yorick and the others all hit the ground. He couldn't tell where the shooting was coming from. "Nelson! Nelson, what is it?" he shouted across the street. "It's a big gun!" Nelson shouted back. Yorick and Di Tommaso looked at each other and rolled their eyes. "Where is it?" he shouted across to Nelson. Nelson pointed up the street, and Yorick edged out to look around the car. There were three dead Somalis on the street. Yorick stood and pulled them together, stacking them, which enabled him to slide out to his left a few feet behind cover. He saw two Somalis stretched out on the ground up the street north, behind a big gun mounted on a tripod. From that position, the gun controlled the street. Behind the tree, across the street, they couldn't see Nelson, and he'd have been a fool to expose his position. Yorick had a law, light anti-tank weapon, strapped to his back that he'd been carrying around on every mission for weeks. It was a lightweight, disposable plastic launcher. It weighed only 3 pounds. He unstrapped it, then climbed up and leaned forward on the car, taking aim with the weapon's flip-up crosshairs. He guessed they were 200 meters away. The rocket launched with a punch of a backblast, and Yorick watched it zoom straight in on his target and explode with a flash and a loud whoom. The gun went flipping up in the air. He was accepting congratulations on his shooting when the thunk, thunk, thunk resumed. The rocket had evidently landed just short, close enough to send the weapon flying and kick up a cloud of dirt, but evidently not close enough to destroy it or stop its shooters. He saw them up the street now, kneeling behind the weapon, which they'd righted again on its bipod. Yorick picked up a law that someone had discarded nearby, but it looked bent and crushed. He couldn't get it to open up, so he loaded a 40-millimeter 203 round into the grenade launcher mounted under the barrel of his M16. This time, his aim was better. You could actually see the fat 203 round spiral into a target, and this one spun square into the center. The two Sammies just fell over sideways in opposite directions. He presumed the gun was destroyed. When the smoke cleared, he could see it just lying there between the two men. No one else came out to get it. Yorick and the others kept a good eye on that gun until nightfall. Chapter 10 Barton and Nelson were behind a tree on the northeast corner of the big intersection directly west of the crash. A little Fiat was parked against the tree. It looked like the driver had left it with the gas cap wedged tightly against the tree to prevent Mogadishu's alert and enterprising thieves from siphoning the gas. Nelson had his M60 machine gun propped on the roof of the car with belts of ammo draped over the side. From the two dead Somalis on the street alongside the car, blood formed red-brown pools in the sand. "It can't get much worse than this," Barton said. Just then, an RPG exploded against the opposite wall with a brilliant flash and a chest-wrenching blast. This made them laugh. Laughter was a bomb. It held panic at bay, and it seemed to come easily. In these extreme circumstances, it became unbearably funny just to act normal. If they could still laugh, they were all right. This was definitely more fire than they'd ever expected to experience in Mogadishu. Nobody had anticipated a serious fight from these characters. Nelson wondered where his friends Casey Joyce and Dom Pilla and Kevin Snodgrass were, and how they were faring. It was raining RPGs.
They would drop down from the north and hit the side of the stone buildings and splash along the walls, great streaking explosions like someone throwing fireballs. "God damn, Twombly, this is unreal," Nelson said. He crouched down behind a 2-foot concrete ramp between the tree and the wall and was fiddling with his M60 when a Somali ducked out from behind a tin shed about 10 feet up the street and fired at him and Twombly. Nelson knew he was dead. Rounds hit between his legs, and he felt them passing next to his face. Twombly dropped the man. Nelson saw Twombly mouth the words, "You okay?"
"I don't know."
Twombly had fired his saw about 2 feet in front of Nelson's face, so close that his cheeks and nose had been singed by the muzzle heat. The blast had hammered his eardrums, blinded him, and his head was still ringing.
"That hurt," Nelson complained. "I can't hear, and I can't see. Don't you ever fucking shoot your weapon off that close to me again."
Just then, another Somali took a shot at them, and Twombly returned fire with his rifle directly over Nelson's head. After that, Nelson wouldn't hear a thing for many hours. Chapter 11 Sergeant Paul Howe and the three men of his Delta team had still been back on the target house roof when they saw the CSAR team roping down from a Black Hawk about a quarter mile northeast. They watched while the Black Hawk took the RPG hit, with men still on its ropes, and were amazed at how the pilot held the bird steady after being hit until the last men were down. Howe knew something was going on over there, but since he had no radio link to the command net and had been too busy inside the target house to notice that a Black Hawk had been shot down, he didn't know why the CSAR team was roping in. He got the full story when he was summoned downstairs by the Delta ground commander, Captain Scott Miller. "We're going to move over there and secure it," Miller said. He explained that the ground convoy, which was loading the Somali prisoners out front, would drive over to the crash site. The rest of them were going to move there on foot. Ranger Chalk 1, led by Captain Steele, would take the lead. The operators would follow, and Ranger Chalk 3 on the south end of the target, led by Sergeant Sean Watson, would bring up the rear. Howe knew the fight was bad and worsening out on the streets. The idea of moving on foot over to where he'd seen the CSAR bird rope its crew in was daunting. He thought, "This is going to be fun." Captain Steele saw the operators come spilling out of the courtyard, moving east toward him. This posed a novel situation for the Ranger commander. He and his men had trained to provide protection for Delta, but the two units didn't mix. Each had its own chain of command, its own separate radio links, and most importantly, its own way of doing things. Now they were being thrown together for this move over to the downed Black Hawk. Steele and Miller conferred briefly about how to proceed, and agreed that the Rangers should take front and rear positions. This column of about 80 men would set off on foot just minutes after Lieutenant Colonel McKnight's ill-fated convoy departed the target building. While that convoy wandered hopelessly lost through the city, getting hammered, and while Durant's Black Hawk was crashing about a mile southwest, this force of D-boys and Rangers were having their own tragic difficulties, moving on foot to the first crash site. They hadn't run more than a block when Sergeant Aaron Williamson got hit. He had been shot earlier. The round had taken off the tip of his index finger, but Williamson had kept fighting. Lieutenant Perino heard someone scream and turned to see Williamson rolling on the street, writhing and screaming, holding his left leg. "I've got a man down," Perino radioed up to Steele. "Pick him up and keep on moving," Steele said. As Howe and his team ran past Williamson, there were 5 Rangers stooped around the wounded man. "Keep moving and let the medic handle it," Howe shouted at them.
Williamson was carried back up the street to one of the Humvees in the ground convoy, which was about ready to roll. Specialist Stebbins, the company clerk, along for his first real mission, was out in front. His blocking position had been at the southeast corner, and they were moving east now. He trotted, crouched and careful, staying away from the walls as the D-boys had advised. Every few feet down the road, a doorway would open into a small courtyard. As Stebbins came upon one door, a Somali came running out of the building into the courtyard, and Stebbins fired. It was instinctive. The man startled him. Bang! Bang! Two rounds. The man dropped to a sitting position, clutching his chest and looking amazed. Then he slumped over forward and began to rock and moan. He was a big man with short hair. He was wearing this disco-style bright blue shirt with long sleeves and a big collar. Most of the Sammies were dusty and wore shabby clothes, but this man was dressed nicely and he was clean. He had on corduroy bell-bottom pants, and his belt had a big die-cast metal buckle. He seemed completely out of place. Stebbins had just shot him. He had never shot anyone before. This all took place in seconds, but it seemed much longer. Stebbins was readying to shoot the man again when his weapon was grabbed by Private Carlos Rodriguez. "Don't waste your rounds on him, Stebby," he said. "Just keep moving." Steele, who had a radio strapped to his broad back, fell further and further behind Lieutenant Perino and the rest of Chalk One. The idea was to stay spread out and provide covering fire for each other as they went through intersections. But right away, to Steele's dismay, the formation broke down. The D-boys ignored the marching orders and just kept moving forward. These were men trained to think for themselves and act independently in battle, and now they were doing it. Each of the operators had a radio earpiece under their little plastic hockey helmets. Steele called them skateboard helmets, and a microphone that wrapped around to their mouth. So they were usually in constant touch with each other. When the radios were not working, or when the noise level was too high, as it was now, the D-boys communicated expertly with hand signals. Steele's rangers relied on shouted orders from their officers and team leaders. They were younger, less experienced, and terrified. Some tended to just follow the operators instead of staying with their teams. Steele saw a complete breakdown of unit integrity before they'd moved two blocks. It was typical of the problems he'd had with Delta from the start. For better or worse, the attitudes and practices of the elite commandos started to rub off on his rangers when they began bunking together in the hangar. Before long, everywhere you looked was a teenage soldier in sunglasses with rolled-up shirt sleeves. Privates would pull guard duty in helmet, flak vest, gym shorts, and their regulation brown T-shirts. Younger soldiers began showing more and more impatience with what they saw as meaningless robot ranger formality. When Steele cracked down, a lot of them thought it was because their captain felt threatened by the D-boys. In the year before this deployment, the broad-beamed former lineman moved through his men like muttering Jove through his hinds, the meanest, manliest man in the army. When Specialist Dave Deemer had defeated all comers in an arm-wrestling contest, Steele took him on and beat him, leaving Deemer whining that the captain had cheated. Steele gave the unapologetic impression that he could break you with his bare hands if it weren't for his strict devotion to Jesus and army discipline. He was unbending even when his senior non-coms thought it was time to bend. Like the time back at Fort Bragg, when he'd ordered all the men awakened after midnight because they'd collapsed, with permission from their platoon sergeants, into bunks without cleaning their weapons after a days-long grueling training mission. But no matter how tough Steele was, of course, it was the D-boys who occupied the absolute pinnacle of the macho feeding chain. Most of them were NCOs, and not only did their very presence deflate any of the standard displays of gruff manhood, they were serenely and rather obviously unimpressed with Steele's captaincy. The disdain was mutual. Steele accepted that these operators were good at their jobs, but he wasn't in awe of them. He found their civilian manner and contemptuous attitude toward Ranger discipline hard to take. Sure, it was a good idea to encourage individual initiative and creative thinking in combat, but some of these guys had strayed so far from traditional Army norms, it seemed unhealthy. They could be comically arrogant. When they'd gotten a list of potential target sites, for instance, the D-boys had divvied them up among different teams. Each was assigned to draw up an assault plan. Since his men were involved, Steele had sat in on the meeting when the various schemes were presented. The captain's experience with such a planning session was like this. You sat there and took notes and asked questions, only to make sure you got things down correctly, and then saluted on your way out. The D-boys meeting was a free-for-all. One group would present its plan, and somebody would pipe up, "Why, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard," which would provoke a sturdy, "Fuck you," which quickly degenerated into guys screaming at each other. It looked to Steele like they were about to assume kung fu stances and have it out. Steele could imagine what would happen if a company of Rangers operated that way. Some of his men were still boys. As far as the captain could tell, most had just emerged from a lifetime of lounging on sofas, eating Fritos and watching MTV. Basic and Ranger training had shaped most of them up reasonably well, but the average private in Bravo Company still had a long way to go before qualifying as a professional soldier. There were good time-tested reasons for HUA discipline. It was easy to see why Steele was destined for the losing end of a popularity contest with the D-boys. Most of his men didn't think through the causes. They saw it all as an ego conflict. Like the time Steele was standing in line with his men at mess and spotted Delta Sergeant Norm Hooten carrying a rifle with the safety off. Ranger rules required that any weapon, loaded or unloaded, have the safety on at all times when at the base. It was an eminently sensible rule, a basic principle of handling weapons safely. He tapped the blonde operator on the shoulder and pointed it out. Hooten had held up his index finger and said, "This is my safe." Showed Steele up right in front of his men. Now the very breakdowns the captain had feared were happening when it mattered most. There was nothing he could do about it. As his men passed by helter-skelter, Steele fell back near the middle of the pack. They'd sort things out at the crash site, if they could find it. Nobody was sure exactly where it was. In short order, Howe and his Delta team were in front of the force. Howe saw bullets skipping off the dirt and skimming down the walls, chipping the concrete. He was way past worrying about staying in formation. The street was a kill zone. Survival meant moving like your hair was on fire. It was time to lead by example. The goal was to punch through to the downed helicopter, and every second mattered. If they failed to link up, then there would be two weak forces instead of a single strong one. Two perimeters to defend instead of one. So they moved quickly, but also smartly. As Howe moved, he thought about making every one of his shots count and keeping his back to a wall at all times. They were in a 360-degree battlefield, so keeping a wall behind him meant one angle he couldn't be shot from. At each crossroads, he and his team would pause, watch, and listen. Were bullets hitting walls, bouncing off the streets? Were the shots going left to right or right to left? Every bit of experience and practical knowledge was useful now for staying alive. Were they machine gun bullets or AKs? An AK only has 25 to 30 rounds in a magazine, so if you waited for the lull, Sammy would be reloading when you ran. The most important thing was to keep moving. One of the hardest things in the world to hit is a moving target. He and his team had spent years training with each other, had fought together in Panama and other places, and moved with confidence and authority. Howe felt that they were the perfect soldiers for this situation. They'd learned to filter out the confusion, put up a mental curtain. The only information that came fully through was the most critical at that moment. Howe could ignore the pop of a rifle or the snap of a nearby round. It was usually just somebody shooting air balls. It would take chips flying from a wall near him to make him react. As they moved down the street, it was one fluid process. Scan for threats. Find a safe place to go next. Shoot. Move. Scan for threats. The key was to keep moving. With the volume of fire on these streets, to stop meant to die. The greatest danger was in getting pinned down. The Rangers followed as well as they could, leapfrogging across the intersections. Stebbins and 60-gunner Private Brian Hurd kept up with them, reassured just to be close to the D-boys. These guys knew how to stay alive. Stebbins kept telling himself, "This is dangerous, but we'll make it. It's okay." At the intersections, he would take a knee and shoot while the man in front of him ran. Then the man behind him would tap his shoulder, and he would take off, just closing his eyes and praying and running for all he was worth. Sergeant Goodale, who had once bragged to his mother how eager he was for combat, felt terrified. He was waiting for his turn to sprint across a street when one of the D-boys tapped him on the shoulder. Goodale recognized him. It was the short, stocky one, Earl. Sergeant First Class Earl Fillmore, a good guy. Fillmore must have seen how scared Goodale looked. "You okay?" he asked. "I'm okay." Fillmore winked at him and said, "It's all right. We're coming out of this thing, man." It calmed Goodale. He believed Fillmore. By the time they were three blocks over, Howe's team was way out front. With them were Stebbins, Hurd, Goodale, Perino, Corporal Jamie Smith, and a few other Rangers. They turned left onto Marahan Road, where the alley ended. The wide dirt road sloped uphill slightly, and then downhill for several blocks, so when they made the turn, they were just shy of the crest of a hill. Downhill to the south, they could see Sammy's running every which way. Over the crest of the hill to the north, Howe saw signal smoke from what must have been the crash. They were about 200 yards away. There was a blizzard of fire at that intersection. Automatic rifle fire and RPGs from all directions. Howe felt the force was in peril of getting stuck and cut to ribbons. He shouted back down the street to Captain Miller, "Follow me!" and plunged straight down the left side. Stebbins and several other Rangers followed. Perino, Goodale, Smith, and some others followed Hooten's Delta team across the street and started down the right wall. Immediately behind them was Sergeant First Class John Boswell's Delta team. An RPG exploded on the wall near Howe and his men. Howe felt the wallop of pressure in his ears and chest and dropped to one knee. One of his men had been hit on the left side with a small piece of shrapnel. Howe abruptly kicked in the door to a one-room house on his left. He and his team had learned to move like they owned the world. Every house was their house. If they needed shelter, they kicked in a door. Anyone who threatened them would be killed. It was that simple. No one was inside. They caught their breath and reloaded their weapons. Running with all that gear was exhausting. The body armor was like wearing a wetsuit. They were sweating profusely and breathing heavily. Howe drew his knife and cut away the back of his buddy's shirt to check the wound. There was a small hole in the man's back with about a 2-inch swollen, bruised ring around it. There was almost no blood. The swelling had closed the hole. "You're good to go," Hau told him, and they were out the door and moving again. Moving up in front of Perino, Goodale saw the familiar desert uniforms down the street and inwardly rejoiced. They'd made it. Once they'd linked up, the convoy would arrive, and they could all roll out of this hell. The sun was getting low in the sky. Goodale had promised his fiancée, Kira, that he'd call tonight. He had to get back in time to make that call. Goodale ran up behind Sergeant Chuck Elliott, who was squatting at the corner of the first intersection on the slope, shooting east. Goodale pointed his gun down Marahan Road. He saw Hau and his team pushing on ahead across the street in shadow. The low sun still lit Goodale's side of the street brightly. Because they were on a slope, he could shoot over the heads of the men down the street at Somalis moving 3 or 4 blocks north. It was a long shot, but he had no other targets. It occurred to him that no one was shooting to the left, the alley west. It blinded him to look that way. Goodale turned to squint into the light and pop off a few suppressive rounds when he felt a shooting pain. His right leg seized up, and he fell over backward, right into Perino. He said, "Ow!" A bullet had entered his right thigh and passed through him, leaving a big exit wound on his right buttock. What immediately flashed into Goodale's mind was a story he'd heard about this 10th Mountain Division guy who had lost his hand the week before when a round detonated the grenade in the law he was carrying. He struggled to get the law off his shoulder. Perino couldn't tell what Goodale was doing. "Where are you hit?" he asked. "Right in the ass." Goodale dropped the law and yelled to Elliot, "There's a law right there." Elliot obligingly picked it up. Perino got back on the radio to Steele, who was now trailing the column. "Captain, I've got another man hit." "Pick him up and keep moving," Steele insisted. Instead, Perino moved on across the intersection with some of the other rangers from Chalk One and left Goodale with Sergeant Bart Bullock, the same Delta medic who had earlier in the fight helped patch up Ranger Todd Blackburn after his fall from the Black Hawk. Both Bullock and medic Kurt Schmid had rejoined their Delta units at the target house after sending Blackburn back to base in the 3 Humvee convoy, the one on which Sergeant Pilla had been killed. Schmid was now moving a block north with Perino and several other rangers. Goodale lay back on the dirt as Bullock looked him over. "You got tagged," Bullock said. "You're all right, though. No problem." Goodale was disgusted. Game over. It was the same feeling he'd had getting injured in a football game. They carried you off the field, and you were done. It was disappointing, but if the going had been particularly rough, it could also be a relief. He took off his helmet, then saw an RPG fly past no more than 6 feet in front of him and explode with a stupendous wallop about 20 feet away. He put his helmet back on. This game was most definitely not over. "We need to get off this street," Bullock said. He dragged Goodale into a small courtyard, and the Delta team, headed by Sergeant Hooten, hopped in with them. Goodale asked Bullock for his canteen, which the medic had taken off when removing his gear. Bullock fished it out of Goodale's butt pack and discovered a bullet hole clean through it from the same round that had passed through his body. There was still water in the canteen. "You'll want to keep this," Bullock said. With the men at the rear of the column, Captain Steele's overriding goal was to consolidate his ranger force and reestablish some order. Time was essential here. Steele had been told the convoy would probably reach the crash site before he and his men did. He had just heard on the radio that another Black Hawk had gone down, Durant's, which meant things were that much more urgent. From the C-2 bird, Harrell explained, "We're going to try to get everyone consolidated at the northern site and exfil everyone off the northern site and move to the southern crash site. Over." Steele had about 60 men to account for when those vehicles arrived, and right now he had only a vague idea where they all were. As he arrived at the intersection at the top of the rise, he ran across to the right side of the street with Lieutenant James Lechner and several other rangers. Sergeant Watson and the remainder of Chalk 3 were the last to turn the corner. Steele moved over the slight rise and started down the hill. He had gone only about 10 yards when a burst of fire forced him and those with him to drop. He was on his belly, with his wide face nearly in the sand. Alongside to his left was Sergeant Chris Atwater, his radio man. Prone to Atwater's left was Lieutenant Lechner, Steele's second-in-command. Atwater and Steele, both big men, were trying to take cover behind a tree with a trunk only about 1 foot wide. About 3 strides to their right, Delta team leader Hooten was in a steel doorway to the small courtyard where Bullock had dragged Goodale. Steele was watching another team of operators working their way up the street ahead of him. He intended to follow, but just then one of the D-boys, Fillmore, went limp. His little helmet jerked up and back, and blood came spouting out of his head. It was obviously fatal. Fillmore just crumpled. An operator grabbed Fillmore and began dragging him into a narrow alley. Then he was shot in the neck. Steele felt the gravity of their predicament hit fully home. This is for keeps. Chapter 12. Mohammed Sheikh Ali moved swiftly around his neighborhood. Ali had been fighting in these streets already for a decade, since he was 14 years old, and had been drummed into Siad Barre's army. He moved mostly in crowds, darting from hiding place to hiding place, usually staying far enough away to make himself a hard target, but occasionally stealing close enough to fire off a few well-placed rounds from his AK. If the Americans spotted him, they saw a short, dusty little man with nappy hair, whose teeth were brownish-orange from chewing cot, and whose eyes were wide with the effects of the drug and adrenaline. Sheikh Ali was a professional gunman, a killer, a man who had fought for and against the dictator, and then had put himself and his weathered weapon up for hire. Most Somalis had come to regard Sheikh Ali and men like him as a plague. They were feared and despised. Now, with the Rangers to fight, men like him were valued again. To him, the Americans were just a new enemy to shoot at, and not a particularly brave one. Ali believed if the Rangers didn't have the helicopters helping them from above, he and his men would surround and kill them with ease, with their bare hands. He relished the fight. There was no quarter given on either side. The black vests who came with the Rangers were especially ruthless killers. When they had come to Bakara Market, they had come into his home uninvited, and they would have to accept his punishment. Sheikh Ali believed the radio broadcasts and flyers printed up by the IDs SNA. The Americans wanted to force all Somalis to be Christians, to give up Islam. They wanted to turn Somalis into slaves. When the helicopter was shot down, he rejoiced and began running toward it. Unlike most of the crowd, he did not run directly to the crash. He knew there would be armed men around it, and that the Rangers would move to it. It would not be easy to get close. Sheikh Ali was part of a large number of irregular militia moving in the crowds that had begun to form a wide perimeter in the neighborhood around the crashed helicopter. He ran up a street parallel to the moving Rangers. He would run to a corner, wait by it, and shoot as the Rangers came across. Then he would sprint to the next street and be waiting for them again. He was not weighted down with armor and gear, and he was not being shot at from all directions, so he could move faster and more freely than the Rangers. When he got to the perimeter around the crash site, there were crowds, fighters like himself, but mostly people who just came to see, women and children. The Americans were firing down the streets at everyone. Sheikh Ali saw women and children fall. He and several of the men in his band laid down behind a tree and shot at the Americans as they came down the slope toward the alley where the crashed helicopter was. There he saw a ranger shot in the head, one of the black vests with the little helmets. His buddy tried to pull him to safety, and he too was shot in the neck. Then Sheikh Ali and his men moved on. They circled around the neighborhood where the helicopter was down and crept back down toward it on Marahan Road. Sheikh Ali found a tree and lay flat on his stomach behind it. There were Americans on his side of the street, about 2 blocks south, hiding behind a car and a tree and a wall. There were more at the same intersection across the street. Between him and the Americans were more fighters, most of them crazy people with guns who didn't know how to fight. Sheikh Ali waited behind his cover for a clean shot. He was there for almost 2 hours, trading shots with the Americans, before his companion, Abdikadir Ali Noor, was shot. An American down the street behind an M-60 hit Noor with several shots that nearly tore off the left side of his body. Sheikh Ali himself was hit by some shrapnel in the face when an M203 round exploded nearby. He then helped carry his friend to a hospital. Chapter 13. The odor of spent gunpowder had always been sweet for Private David Floyd. It reminded him of home. Out hunting with his father as a boy in South Carolina, which was not that long ago, he was just 19, he would pick up shotgun shells just to sniff them. Now, that odor, which was all around, meant something else. He ran with the others through the gunfire on the street, rounded the corner just behind a team of D-boys, and then jumped for whatever cover he could find on the left side of the street. He tucked himself into a corner by some roofing tin, facing south, disbelieving. It had been an effort to keep moving. There was a big part of Floyd that just wanted to crawl into a little ball and hide somewhere. He knew it would be suicide to stop fighting, but he was that scared. He was scared enough to piss his pants. I'm in it now. It was like a movie, only it was real, and he was in the middle. He couldn't believe he was in actual combat, and people were shooting at him, trying to kill him. I'm gonna die on this dirty little street in Africa. It was much too frantic a moment to be thinking about such things, but it occurred to Floyd anyway, a sudden image in his mind's eye of a late summer Sunday morning at home, with his parents sitting down to breakfast without the slightest notion that their precious son David was here, a million miles away, fighting for his life in this insane city they'd never even heard of, much less cared about. What in the hell am I doing here? The D-boys' presence helped keep those impulses under control. They encouraged the opposite impulse that was there too, which was to fight like hell, use every round and grenade and rocket at hand, use all the training he'd been given to inflict as much punishment as possible. Because it made him mad. To see one of his ranger brothers shot down right beside him. He had seen Williamson go down screaming. It just, well, it pissed Floyd off. So warring with the urge to crawl under a rock was this fury, this cornered animal rage, like, you motherfuckers asked for it. Now you're gonna get it. Then he saw Fillmore get hit. This was not supposed to happen. These guys knew how to stay alive. Holy shit! If the D-boys were getting killed, what odds would you give Private First Class David Floyd for coming out of this alive? He was against the west wall, firing his weapons south pretty rapidly now, down Marahan Road, and realizing that the pile of tin around him was no real shelter at all. In the middle of the street, right in the middle, Specialist John Collette had crawled behind a hump in the road and was providing superb covering fire to the south with his saw. Across the street was Sergeant Watson with a group of other rangers. Watson led the group with his own grim sense of humor. When a barrage of bullets slammed into a wall directly over his head, Watson turned to the men with his eyes open comically wide. "Oh, this sucks," he said, in a way that made the others smile. His attitude was, "We're in the shit now, but what the fuck?" Sergeant Kenny Thomas was closest to Fillmore when he got hit. "Can you call for a medevac?" shouted Hooten. Thomas ran back to Watson, who only heard the last part of what Thomas said. Watson knew there was no way they were going to be able to get Fillmore out, but he didn't have the heart to tell Thomas. "Go ahead and ask the captain," he said. So Thomas ran as far as he could in Steele's direction, then shouted, "We've got a head wound. We have to get him out." Steele gestured for Thomas to wait a second as he talked on the radio. Then he called back. "Is he one of ours?" Weren't they all one of ours? "A Delta guy," Thomas shouted. Thomas was distressed. He'd never seen a man shot in the head. "Just calm down," said Watson when Thomas returned. The sergeant said maybe they could get him on a vehicle. Where the hell were those vehicles anyway? When they left for the crash site, the convoy had been on the street right behind them. Thomas ran back to Hooten. "We can't land a bird in here," Thomas said, "but maybe we can get a Humvee." "It's all right," said Hooten. "He's dead." Thomas felt oddly emotionless about it. He felt angry at Captain Steele for asking, "Is he one of ours?" He also felt like a failure. Colette was feeling good about his spot at the center of Marahan Road. It didn't look like much. Guys on both sides of the street thought he was crazy. But Colette had deduced by the rounds cracking over his head that the hump was excellent cover. It looked to him as if it was the guys who were up and moving who were getting shot. He had good angles, but there was only room for one man. When Private George Siegler started crawling out toward him, Colette shouted, "Siegler, get back over there!" Siegler didn't argue. He just scooted around and crawled back to the wall. Rounds poked through Floyd's tin shelter. Because the sun was low in the sky, when he heard the popping noise, he saw shafts of light suddenly appear through the metal. It was like somebody was shooting at him with a laser. Then he saw Private Peter Nethery get hit across the street against the same wall where Fillmore had been shot. Nethery had been down on the ground working his M60 machine gun when he screamed and rolled away clutching his right arm. Private Vince Errico took over the big gun, and seconds later let out a yelp. He, too, had been hit in the right arm. Both Nethery and Errico were now down, moaning. It was clear that the right side of the wall approaching the intersection, the place where Fillmore had been killed, and where all these other men were being hit, was like a focal point for enemy fire. Walking through it was asking to be shot. The bullet that hit Nethery had torn through his bicep. There was a lot of blood. Doc Richard Strauss calmly examined it as Nethery looked up at Thomas. "Damn, Sergeant, I hope they send me home for this." "Does it hurt?" Thomas asked. "Hell yeah. I'm all right, though. I do believe in God." "That's okay," said Thomas. "He believes in you, too." Thomas took over the M60. He was squinting west, desperately looking for the shooter who had such a bead on them. Floyd and Specialist Melvin DeJesus were doing the same from their low vantage point in the shade. Floyd was feeling hopeless. "We're gonna buy it here." Then a single brass cartridge plopped on the street right in front of them. It had to have rolled off the tin roof of the house they were up against. Whoever was up there would have a clear shot at the men along the sunny east wall. Floyd stood. He wasn't tall enough to see up on the roof, but he could reach it with his saw. He placed the gun roughly parallel to the rooftop and squeezed a long burst. He heard a loud thumping and a shout. The shooting from that direction stopped. Someone else was shooting from a courtyard to the south. Thomas had used up all the M60 ammo that was left, and he'd already tossed a grenade in that courtyard, and Floyd and DeJesus sprayed rounds toward it to no effect. They could see big muzzle flashes splash out from behind a low masonry wall backed with bushes. "Use the law!" Floyd shouted. Thomas had one of the disposable rocket launchers strapped to his back, but it was so lightweight and rarely used, it was easy to forget about it. He looked back at Floyd quizzically. "The law! The law! On your back!"